Remember, so far in this course, we did everything we did without having introduced the notion of distance. We had open neighborhoods, we had all kinds of derivatives, but we didn't have a notion of invariant distance. To that end, we introduced the so-called metric tensor. And of course, you know it already from special relativity and the first course in general relativity. So let's remind ourselves. The distance between two events, the invariant distance between two events is defined in this way as the distance between the times squared, the difference between the distance in time squared and difference in space squared, written usually in the form of, by using an eta matrix, where we use this signature here with a minus one and these with plus ones. This is all Minkowski space, just special relativity. Now, even in special relativity, we may want to choose a coordinate system other than a Cartesian coordinate system. We can choose any wild coordinate system we want. So what happens if we, in Minkowski space, write down the distance in some other coordinate system? Well, then it's still going to be some expression that involves x and x hat, the two events coordinates. But in this new wild coordinate system, it's not going to be the eta matrix that determines the distance. Instead, it's going to be some really complicated expression, typically a power series or non-trivial function in the x and the x hat, that gives us the distance between two events. But we can do an expansion, and then to lowest order, we get something like this, plus higher order things. Right, so it's an expansion on those distances. And the G mu is in general not eta mu. So if somebody gives you such a G mu, then you can change coordinates back to a Cartesian coordinate system, and you obtain that the G mu transforms into an eta mu everywhere. Now, historically, the generalization to curved space-time proceeded from that observation. The idea was that we allow for infinitesimal distances, I mean this formula here, see, this formula here becomes exact if you look at infinitesimal distances where the higher powers in the delta x's can be neglected. This becomes an exact formulation. And historically, the idea was that we allow for metric tensors g mu of x such that in no coordinate system, they can be of the form eta mu nu. You see, the key thing is this. In Minkowski space, the metric takes the form eta mu nu in Cartesian coordinates. If you choose another coordinate system, like spherical coordinates or so, then the metric can take a very different form. And if you choose some really wild coordinates, the metric tensor will take some really wild form, g mu of x. But then if you transform back into the original Cartesian coordinate system or a Lorentz transformed version of it, then you get eta mu nu back. Now, if somebody gives you a matrix valued function g mu nu of x and doesn't tell you whether or not this is actually eta mu nu in funny coordinates or it's not, well, then it's hard to try out. It's hard to find out whether g mu nu has a transformation to eta mu nu or not. And the original idea of those who went beyond special relativity, Einstein and Hilbert, was that we should consider g mu nu of x's that in no coordinate system reduce to eta mu nu. This would describe new kinds of space-times beyond Minkowski space. or mathematically speaking, we can group all functions g mu of x, all matrix valued functions g mu of x, that can be transformed into each other by diffeomorphisms, can be grouped into one equivalence class. These are metrics up to diffeomorphism. And then special relativity would be one of them, one of those equivalence classes, namely the set of all those g mu of x that you can get by a diffeomorphism, by a change of coordinates from the eta mu. But of course, there are way more equivalence classes, and each equivalence class corresponds to a space-time. However, one constraint had to be kept. The g mu of x couldn't just be anything. The g mu of x had to be such that if I pick a point, any point, then there had to be a coordinate system in which, at that point, g mu took the form eta mu. And this is the equivalence principle. This says that at every point of the space-time, there should be a coordinate system in which, in the immediate neighborhood, it looks like we are living in special relativity. So in order to enforce Einstein's equivalence principle, we require the g mu not to be completely arbitrary matrix-valued functions of space and time, but know for every x, for every point in the manifold, there ought to exist a coordinate system such that, at least at that point, the g mu of x becomes eta mu of x. In general, this function is not going to be eta mu away from that point. You can only guarantee it for one point. Now, the mathematical definition of the metric tensor, generalizing special relativity, is that the G is, just like eta was, a covariant tensor of rank 0,2. So it's a covariant 2 tensor. And we want it to be symmetric. Now, if we have n cotangent vector fields, let's say theta mu, that form a basis at each point of the manifold, then any covariant 2 tensor can be written in this form. Okay, so assume that these form, at every point of the manifold, these form a basis in the cotangent space. We could choose the dx mu, for example, for a given coordinate system. Remember that the dx mu, the differentials x mu, form a basis of the cotangent space. But we could choose any basis we want. So let's call the choice of basis that we make for the cotangent space the vectors theta mu. At every point in the space-time, we get to make that choice. So this represents a choice of basis in every one of the tangent spaces. At every point x, we make a separate choice of basis here. Now, relative to this choice of basis in the cotangents, in the space of cotangent vectors, here are all the basis vectors. Relative to that, we can always write down our covariant 2 tensor. It's some coefficient function times these basis vectors. What would happen to this formula if we change to a new coordinate system that we may call x bar? You know what would happen to this formula? You would just replace the x's by x bars. That's all. There's no Lorentz transformations in here. There's no dx mu's by dx, dx's by dx bars, or anything like that occurring in here. The reason is that this is a certain choice of basis in a tangent vector. That's basis tangent vector. And these are coefficient functions. These are, even though they carry indices, these guys are coefficient functions. They are in lambda 0. They are in f over m. They are just scalar functions, each one of them. And if we change coordinate system, it means we relabel the x's. But if all we do is change coordinate system, but we keep our choice of basis vectors theta, well, then these guys don't change. They're just then theta of x bar, theta of x bar, and g mu nu of x bar. Nothing changes. If in a vector space you don't change the vector, then nothing changes. I mean, it stays the same vector. And we're keeping even the basis, so the coefficients don't change either. Only if we chose for these basis vectors the dx mu, then as we go to new coordinates, we get dx bar mu. That's a different choice of basis, and therefore the coefficients would change. All right. So the g mu nu, we want to be invertible. We want the g mu nu of x matrix to be invertible, which is to say that there exists a tensor that we will call G inverse, which will be of rank 2, 0, so twofold contravariant. And as a twofold contravariant vector, we can expand it in any basis of the space of twofold contravariant tensors. And if the E nu are some arbitrary choice of basis of the tangent space, then taking two of them with the tensor product of them, that forms a basis of the space of twofold contravariant tensors. And so our G inverse can be written in this way. It's some coefficient functions multiplying these basis vectors in the space of twofold contravariant tensors. And then the fact that G inverse should be the inverse of G means that, you know, if you just apply this to that, so you feed one leg of that into one leg of this, then you get Kronecker deltas, and you find that the coefficient matrices have to obey this relationship that they are the inverses of each other. So that leads us to another view to the Einstein equivalence principle. Remember that we asked that for every point in the manifold, there is a coordinate system such that when choosing the traditional basis in the tangent and cotangent spaces, then the metric tensor takes the form, this form with respect to the usual basis vectors and the with the coefficient functions g mu nu of x just being obtained by plugging the basis vector, the dual basis of the tangent vectors into here. Anyway, but to complete the sentence, we require that at every point in the manifold there exists a coordinate system such that the metric becomes the metric coefficient, the coefficient matrix of the metric becomes eta mu nu at that point. But you see, this is a requirement that makes sense if you automatically, instinctively choose this basis in the cotangent space once you have a coordinate system. We don't have to do that. And so what we can also say is, once we free ourselves from that choice of basis, that independently of any choice of coordinate system, there are choices of dual bases, namely the thetas for the cotangent space and basis vectors E for the tangent space, such that G mu nu of X is eta mu nu at all points of the manifold. Right, so now we don't have to just say there exists a coordinate system such that at any particular point it becomes eta mu nu. No, now we can require that the metric tensor's coefficient matrix is eta mu nu everywhere on the manifold at the same time. Of course, these basis vectors theta mu nu are not going to be the dx mu. They will not achieve that.
Mm-hmm. This particular case, does that mean you already chose an orthonormal tetrad everywhere, or?
Yes, exactly. That's what we do. it says, the equivalence principle says, we must be able to choose our basis vectors in such a way that that's the case. It's not going to be unique, because you can always change your basis by a Lorentz transformation, and it will still have that property that in that new basis, the metric tensor still has that form. If it had it before the Lorentz transformation, it will have it after the Lorentz transformation. And that links up to the gauge principle. The choice of basis in the tangent and cotangent spaces, which will make the metric look like that everywhere, that choice of basis is not unique. It is unique only up to a local choice of Lorentz transformation. At every point in space-time, you can choose a Lorentz transformation and move around your basis, rotate around your basis according to Lorentz transformations, because that will not change that property. By definition, Lorentz transformations leave that the same. And that is similar, at least in spirit, it is quite similar to what is the gauge principle for electromagnetism, the weak and the strong force. There, too, we have that the same physics is described. No matter what local rotation we do in a so-called isospin of space, which in the case of electromagnetism is just a U1, it's just a phase, a complex number, it's a complex number of modulus 1. In the case of the weak interaction, it is an SU2, and the two are really unified. And then for the strong interaction, it's an SU3. And these SU3 representation vectors, or SU2 representation vectors, live in what is called an internal space. You can't really visualize them, what they do. They're just attached to the spin of fields of quarks and electrons and neutrinos and so on. But here in general relativity, the gauge group, which is the local Lorentz transformations, act on external degrees of freedom. They act on the actual four vector indices. So it's close, but general relativity is much more nonlinear than usual gauge theories. Yeah, so there are two main differences between general relativity as a gauge theory and the other three forces as gauge theories. One of the differences being that general relativity is much more nonlinear, and the other difference is that the gauge transformations are local Lorentz transformations, which have an intuitive interpretation because they're external degrees of freedom, whereas the local gauge transformations of the regular gauge theories, the strong, weak, and electromagnetic interactions, are happening in internal gauge degrees of freedom. Okay, so now having introduced the metric tensor, we are able to calculate small distances. From that, from the ability to calculate the invariant distance between two nearby events, many things follow. We can now introduce new concepts that we could not introduce before. In this course, I try to introduce everything that can be introduced without the metric early on, and then everything we do now can only be done with the metric. Everything new that we do now can only be done with the metric. So in particular, now that we know how to calculate infinitesimal distances, we should be able to calculate volumes because of it. We introduced earlier a volume form, and we said, well, it just should be a top form, it should be an N form that never vanishes. But now, intuitively, it's clear that given that we have a notion of distance on a manifold now, we should be able to calculate volumes as well. The notion of volume should not be independent of the notion of distance. The mathematics doesn't require it, but the physics kind of demands it. So that's one of the things we will be able to do. Another is that the metric and its inverse give us a duality between the covariant and contravariant vectors. Now you might think, well, we've had that. We knew that covectors are dual to vectors. Contravariant vectors and covariant vectors are dual to each other. One acts as a linear form on the other. So what's new here? Well, what's new is that with a metric, you have a canonical map that maps contravariant vectors into covariant vectors. That didn't exist before. Before the introduction of the metric tensor, we had no canonical way of associating tangent vectors to cotangent vectors. Then the metric also gives us, I mean, I'm just giving an overview and then we go into the details of it. The metric also gives us a map called the Hodge star. And it's an important concept, but it's not immediately obvious what it does. So the Hodge star will be a map, a linear map, that takes in P forms and then produces N minus P forms. So for example, in space-time, if you apply with the apply the Hodge star on a one form, you get a three form. If you apply it to a zero form, you get a four form, and so on. Now, so what is it good for? Using the Hodge star, we can turn the space of P forms into a Hilbert space, which is going to be very convenient and useful, but not necessarily true. The thing is that this actually relies on the metric being positive definite. And when it's not positive definite, then the Hodge star will give us an inner product that's not necessarily positive definite, and it's not going to be a Hilbert space. Not all of those lambda p's are going to be Hilbert spaces. That's a bit of a headache for general relativity. but we will still have some Hilbert spaces. Also, once we have this inner product structure, which may or may not be a Hilbert space, but we do have an inner product structure, once we have that, so in a sense, star is generalizing G. G is giving us an inner product on tangent vectors. Because you take a tangent vector, you have two tangent vectors, you want to know the inner product of them, the scalar product of those. Then you can take one of them and map it using G into a cotangent vector, which you can then apply to the tangent vector and get a number. And here it's similar. The star allows you to take a P form, gives you an N minus P form, and then you can combine the two to get the N form, which you can then integrate to get a number. So G also gives us a so-called co-derivative. And that is basically the adjoint to the exterior derivative. When you have an inner product space, think of a Hilbert space, you have an operator, then you can look at the adjoint operator, like A and A dagger. And the exterior derivative has an adjoint with regards to that inner product, and that's going to be the co-derivative. The exterior derivative D we use to define closed differential forms and exact differential forms. The adjoint of D we can use to define co-closed and co-exact differential forms. So we will have the co-derivative. And you may wonder, where does that lead us? Just yet another derivative. it's just another derivative, but it's a very important one. Because once we have both the co-derivative and the exterior derivative that we had from earlier on, where, remember, the exterior derivative, doesn't know about the metric. You can evaluate it without ever consulting what the metric does. This, the co-derivative, has the metric in it, because all of the above require the metric. Also, it's not a derivation. Anyway, if you have both of them, then you can combine them to get the Laplacian or, in the Lorentzian signature case, the D'Alembert operator. And that's, of course, super important because we need the Laplacian and D'Alembert operators to write down wave equations on the manifold. So in order to describe how physics happens on a space-time, other than the curvature itself, we will need these operators. Okay, so now we go through this list one by one, but in detail. This was just to give you a flavor of what's going to come up. We start with this proposition. Let's say we are given a notion of distance, that is to say a metric tensor, g. Then this induces for us a volume form omega. How? I mean, it's clear intuitively that it ought to. If you can measure tiny distances, you should be able to measure tiny areas, tiny volumes, and so on. But how can it do it? And we can recognize the expression in the metric that we need to get the volume form by the transformation properties. We know how the volume form is supposed to transform. And so we are basically looking for an expression in the metric which transforms the way that the volume form is supposed to transform. No, volume forms are top forms, are N forms. That determines how they are supposed to transform. And I can already give it away. You see, a volume form transforms according to the Jacobian of the transformation, of the coordinate transformation, because as a top form, it's totally anti-symmetrized. And that translates into the determinant. And so we should expect that the determinant of the metric will come in. And that's, of course, what will happen. So let's assume, as always, that the manifold is oriented. Then let's consider a positive chart. Positive being defined relative to the orientation that we assume is given. Then we can define omega, and it will turn out to be a volume form. We can define omega to be square root of the absolute value of the determinant of g multiplied with this basis vector in the space of n forms. There's, of course, only one basis vector in the space of n forms. So the claim is that this is a well-defined volume form. Let's prove that. First, let's see, is it really non-zero for all points of the manifold? Yes, it is, because G is assumed non-degenerate. Remember, at every point, we can make it eta mu nu. So its determinant is not zero. Also, is it well-defined? Is it a chart-independent definition? And it is. To see that it is, let me just give you an example for why this is non-trivial. Imagine we defined the volume form to be this to the power of 27. That wouldn't be a coordinate system independent definition. But with the power of just 1/2, it is. And here's how we see that. So let's say we do a change of coordinate system from x to x tilde. Then the metric transforms. And of course, you recognize we are using here the physicist's definition again. And we choose as basis vectors the basis vectors that come with the choice of coordinate system and so on. We are freely moving between the physicist's way of identifying tensors according to their transformation properties under change of coordinates, where we assume that we choose the tension, the cotangent vectors along with the coordinate system as the dxi and d by dxi. And sometimes we do things abstractly. But for this particular proof, it's convenient to use this physicist's picture. So the coefficient matrix of the metric tensor transforms this way if we choose the canonical bases that come with the coordinate system. So as matrices, we have that the G tilde matrix is this matrix, this Jacobian matrix transposed, times the matrix of this G times that Jacobian matrix. And just on the basis of linear algebra, we know that if we have a matrix equal to a matrix times matrix times matrix, then the determinants behave this way. The determinant of this is the determinant of that times the determinant of that times the determinant of that. And the determinants are commutative because they're just numbers. So it's really the determinant of this is the determinant of that squared times the determinant of G. Which is to say that the determinant of G tilde to the power of 1/2 is the absolute value of the determinant of the Jacobian matrix times the determinant of G. But also, we have that when we take this basis vector in the space of n forms, dx tilde 1 to dx tilde n, then its transformation property is, and we discussed that earlier, is that it multiplies the old basis, dx1 to dxn, with the determinant of the Jacobian. Because we really have a linear combination here. If you put here the dx by dx tilde Jacobian matrices in here, then you get lots of sums, but only the anti-symmetric terms will survive, and then the anti-symmetric terms can all be rearranged so that they have the order dx1 to dxn, and they pick up plus or minus signs depending on the order of the permutation, and that's how you build up the determinant here. So what we have is that the square root of g tilde's determinant times that, so this times that over here is the square of the, not the square of the determinant, it's this determinant times the determinant inverse, this is just arranged in this way, times g to the power 1/2 times that. So what we find is that in the new coordinate system with the g tilde, we get the same exact form as in the old coordinate systems without the tildes. If we had chosen any power other than 1/2, we would not have gotten that. So it's got to be the power 1/2. And that's true for any dimension. The number of dimensions did not get into that calculation. So how does it look like explicitly, this volume form? What are its coefficients? What are its coefficients as a covariant 0n tensor? Remember, an n form is above all a tensor. It's a covariant tensor. It's an n-fold covariant tensor that's totally anti-symmetric. Now, let us define this matrix, epsilon matrix, with indices i1 to in, and we legislate that the matrix elements of this multi-index matrix are plus 1 if the integers that occur here are in a positive permutation, and it's minus 1 if they're in a negative permutation. Positive meaning that in an even number, you can get from the ordered sequence 1, 2, 3 to n to the sequence in question, and you call it a negative permutation if you get there by an odd number of permutations. And otherwise, if any of the indices occur more than once, then it's 0. So this is a totally anti-symmetric matrix. Then, with this definition, the volume form can be written in this way. It is, as we just defined it, the square root of g times the basis vector. And the n form's basis vector can be spelled out as a n tensor, as a 0n tensor. Remember how that works? The veg product of all these basis vectors is obtained by taking all possible tensor products of these and anti-symmetrizing them. So that's achieved by writing down all possible tensor products of all those vectors here, and then summing of all indices with this epsilon matrix that will take care of the plus or minus signs. So from here to here, we are simply recalling what the definition of the wedge product was, total anti-symmetrization.
Shouldn't there be a factorial turnover? Because you are summing a lot of even permutations.
Yes, but it's absorbed. I can't scroll back to the definition now.
Since every form is one form over here, so you divide it one factorial, so you do nothing.
Hmm?
I mean, in the definition, it's like a k factorial, l factorial over k plus l factorial, but
yes.
Here they're all one form, so.
Yeah, I mean, I know it's correct, but I can't tell you now about the factorials here. I don't remember exactly how they went. He might be right that this is why it pans out. Okay, so assuming now that the factorials pan out, I know the formulas are right like that, then we can identify what the matrix elements are of the volume form, namely the matrix elements have to be exactly those. So if you write the volume form as a n-fold covariant tensor, then its matrix elements are these. Depending on whether we are dealing with the Riemannian or Lorentzian manifold case, so the metric being either positive definite or the metric being the one with a minus sign for the time coordinate, omega will be called the Riemannian or metric volume form or pseudo-Riemannian volume form in the case of space-time. Okay, so that completes the first point in our list of things that we can now that we have a metric. The next task was to develop the tools to be able to write down wave equations on space-time, on curved space-time. So this was the major other use of G. We need G to formulate the D'Alembertian, which I think is an interesting thing to keep in mind. Without a definition of metric, we would not be able to write down the wave equation of a Klein-Gordon field. Does that also mean that we would not be able to write down the wave equation of electromagnetism, Maxwell equations? It turns out some of them we can do without metric, and some of them we cannot do without metric. But the Klein-Gordon equation definitely does require the metric. Okay, so we will need the metric to formulate the D'Alembertian or the Laplace operator. And why is that? Well, let's see, the D'Alembertian or the Laplace operator, we know from special relativity, should be a second derivative, a kind of second derivative, the sum of the second partial derivatives, for example. That's what it would be in flat space. But it also should be a non-directional derivative. The Laplacian doesn't point in any particular direction, or the D'Alembertian. But what can we do? Do we have non-directional derivatives? Well, we have one of them, and that's the exterior derivative, d. So then why don't we just apply it twice? Then we get second derivatives, non-direction. We can't do that because d squared is zero. The boundary of a boundary does vanish, and so does d squared. So what we need is a D'Alembertian which maps zero forms into zero forms in a non-directional way, but second derivatives. The D itself maps zero forms into one forms into two forms, etc. So if we had another derivative that does the opposite, that is of degree minus one, so it would take one forms into zero forms, then we could combine it with the D and get a second derivative that maps zero forms into zero forms, and perhaps P forms into P forms. So that's going to be the strategy. We use G, first of all, to establish the equivalence between covariant and contravariant vectors. We already discussed that the metric can be used to map covariant vectors into contravariant vectors, but this generalizes to all kinds of tensors. You know it already as lowering and raising indices, of course, using the metric. And then we use that trick together with the Hodge star to obtain a map from R forms into N minus R forms. That will allow us to define inner product spaces, which in lucky scenarios are Hilbert spaces. And that will allow us to take the adjoint of operators on that Hilbert space, in particular the adjoint of D. The exterior derivative will be the co-derivative, and it maps lambda R into lambda R minus 1. Therefore, if we combine this co-derivative del with D, we can actually get a non-directional second derivative. And that's going to be the Laplacian or D'Alembertian. Usually called the Laplacian on Riemannian manifold, usually called the D'Alembertian on Lorentzian manifolds, but mathematicians wouldn't care. They would always call it Laplacian, even if the metric is indefinite. So the D'Alembertian will be defined as the anti-commutator of D with del. Do you remember seeing previously something defined as the anti-commutator of the D with something?
Derivative.
Lie derivative, right. There it was the anti-commutator between D and the inner derivation. And now it's going to be the D with the del. And once we have that, once we have the D'Alembert operator, well, then we can write down, for example, the Klein-Gordon equation. But actually, this D'Alembert operator, while it will map zero forms into zero forms, and that's what phi is, a zero form, a function, this D'Alembert operator acts on all differential forms. It gives us also a kind of Klein-Gordon equation for vector fields, a kind of Klein-Gordon equations for two tensors, for three tensors. I mean, for three forms and two forms and four forms and so on. So let's start with the covariant-contravariant tensor equivalence using the metric. So the metric maps contravariant vectors into covariant vectors because it has two covariant components. You can feed one of its components a tangent vector and you're left with a cotangent vector, so that's how that maps. Namely, you take your metric tensor and you take a tangent vector. These are coefficient functions multiplied with basis vectors. Again, if you change coordinate system, what will happen to this? Nothing, right? If you don't change the basis vectors, you don't change the coefficient functions either. If you change coordinate system, only this x would go into x of x bar. If the new coordinates are called x bar, coefficient functions would be the same. So your metric can take as input a tangent vector, and then as output, it produces a cotangent vector. In which way? Here is our metric tensor. No basis. This is the basis in the space of covariant two tensors. These are the coefficient functions of the metric. This whole thing is the metric tensor. And then you feed it this tangent vector. Which is to say, you feed this tangent vector here into the second slot, and then these are just coefficient functions. They can move in the front. This is a cotangent vector, which maps tangent vectors linearly into the real numbers, and we choose them to be dual bases, of course, and therefore this is just going to be a Kronecker delta here. Therefore, the cotangent vector that we obtain by plugging this tangent vector into the metric is given by this coefficient vector multiplied with these basis vector components. I shouldn't call that coefficient vector. This is coefficients, simply coefficient functions, scalar coefficient functions, elements of f of m. And for the coefficient functions, if we don't care about the basis, if we just say we keep the basis the same anyway, then what the metric does is that it maps a tangent vector's coefficient functions into a cotangent vector's coefficient functions given by this matrix. Conversely, the inverse metric, which is a twofold contravariant tensor, takes cotangent vector as its input and outputs the tangent vector in exactly the same way, just that you have to use the basis of the tangent space here. And the coefficients of the tangent vector that you feed and are mapped into these coefficients of the tangent vector that you get out. So you put in a cotangent vector's coefficients and you get out the tangent vector's coefficients given by this, raising and lowering indices. So in this way, the metric and its inverse can lower or raise any tensor index. And I guess the point of this little calculation was that this is not tied to the usual choice of bases in tangent and cotangent spaces that are tied to the choice of coordinates. Here we allowed ourselves to choose any arbitrary bases in the tangent and cotangent spaces, these thetas and e's and so on. So the raising and lowering indices works the same way as you're always used to do it, even when you make freely use of your freedom to choose bases in the tangent and cotangent spaces whichever way you want. So now the Hodge star can be defined. It will be a map from the space of p forms into the space of n minus p forms. The overall idea is this. Every p form is not just a differential form, it is also a covariant tensor. It's a covariant, it's a zero p tensor. And as a covariant tensor, a covariant p tensor, we can use p copies of the metric to raise all of its p covariant indices. And then it becomes a contravariant tensor. It becomes a p comma zero contravariant tensor. And why would we want to do that? These things are happily covariant because then they transform the right wave to be integrated over. No, there's a point to viewing them as covariant tensors and then using the metric to raise all of their indices. Because once we have raised all of their p indices, then it's just, then the thing becomes a purely contravariant p tensor. Then you can feed it into p slots of the volume form. The volume form is an n-fold covariant tensor, which means that it has openings for up to 10 tangent vectors. You can, up to n tangent vectors, right? So an n form can feed on n tangent vectors and give you a number. And an n form, you can feed a contravariant p tensor, and the volume form will then return an n minus p covariant tensor. Because you're only filling p of the n slots. So that's what we do. We take a p form, we raise its indices, and then we feed it into the volume form. And the result of that is going to be an n minus p form. So overall, we mapped a p form into an n minus p form. And that image we will call star nu. So if nu is a p form, star nu is an n minus p form obtained in this way. Concretely, we take our p form And we write it in terms of coefficients times the basis vectors. And we can write this in terms of the as a tensor. Please don't ask me about the factorials in this case. Whichever way they work out, it's a bit stressful to try to do this on the fly. I'd have to look it up to be sure. Okay. Right, so we take our P form. In this way of writing it, it's clearly a P form. But if we spell out what the wedge product is, then modulo factorials, it's going to be this in terms of a covariant tensor with these coefficients. But remember, they all have lower indices because they're all covariant. Now we use the metric to raise those indices. So we now obtain, from this P form, we obtain a P fold contravariant tensor, which has all these coefficients here obtained from those by raising them with the metric. And because it's contravariant now, after the action of the metric, we have now these dual basis vectors here. So the new tilde coefficient matrix is obtained from the new coefficient matrix by application of P matrix. So we have, as promised, we have a p-fold contravariant tensor. And that p-fold contravariant tensor we feed into the volume form. Here's the volume form. And here's the here's the coefficient matrix of the p-fold contravariant tensor. Then clearly, as far as the coefficients are concerned, the coefficient functions, feeding this contravariant tensor into the volume form means that these indices get contracted with those indices. Actually, these are n indices. Those are just p indices. So n minus p of them are remaining free, and they are being summed over the remaining basis vectors. So this whole thing then becomes, so if you plug the new tilde contravariant tensor into the volume form, it becomes an n minus p form, and that's the star nu. Okay, so star nu is by definition this thing. And if we write it out as a tensor, then it has these coefficients. And if we write it out as a n minus p form, then it has those coefficients with this factorial factor. What happens if we do that again? You see, the star maps a p-form into an n minus p-form. If we now apply the star again, we get a p-form again. Because n minus p, if n minus p-form, right? So let's say we start with a one form in four dimensions, then that will be mapped into a three form. If we then apply the hot star to that, the three form will become a one form. So we get, if you apply the hot star twice, it maps p-forms into p-forms. But it's not exactly the identity that we get. We actually pick up a minus sign depending on what p is, what n is, and what s is. Now for space-time, s is equal to 1. S is the number of minus signs in the metric, in the Minkowski form of the metric. So for space-time, s is 1. For space-time, n is 4. So for example, if we look at zero forms, then we would have that p is equal to 0, s is equal to 1, so it's a minus 1. So on zero forms, we have that we pick up a minus sign. On one forms, we would have 4 minus 1 is 3, times 1 is still 3, plus 1 is 4. So that's even, so that's just a plus 1. So hot star twice applied to one forms gives us the exact same one form again. Now, why did we introduce the hot star? Remember, we want Hilbert spaces, at least inner product spaces, even if that inner product is not necessarily positive definite. So the hot star will provide us with a scalar product or inner product for our Grassmann algebra. Remember, there's no P in here, so it's just a linear combination of all of those spaces of differential P forms. The inner product is defined in this way. Take a P form and another P form. The inner product is supposed to give us a number. Just like the scalar product on a Hilbert space usually does, a Hilbert space of functions. You take two functions, you should be able to get a number for the inner product. The definition here is that alpha is a P form, beta is a P form. You take alpha veg star of beta. So beta is a P form, star beta is an N minus P form. So now you have an N minus P form veg a P form. So the total degree of this will be N minus P plus P, so it's just N. Therefore, this is going to be an N form, the whole thing. It's a P form times an N minus P form. So it's an N form, and that we can integrate over the manifold because the manifold is N dimensional. So that's the procedure. Take two P forms, their inner product is given by the integral over the N form that you obtain by taking alpha veg star beta. It turns out that for the case that we might be most interested in, which is the space of zero forms, so if alpha and beta are just functions on the manifold, we have that this inner product is indeed positive definite. No matter what. It doesn't matter what the signature of the metric is. So whether it's a Riemannian manifold or Lorentzian manifold, this is always a positive definite inner product on the space of zero forms. But it's not true for other forms. I think for one forms already it's not true. So for one forms, this is not guaranteed to be always positive. I mean, as a positive definite inner product. So you could have that alpha comma alpha is not positive. But since it is positive for zero forms, we can use this to define a Hilbert space for zero forms. Because that gives us the inner product that turns the vector space of zero forms into a Hilbert space. We can then complete that space and so on. So luckily that works even for space-time, even when the signature is that of the Lorentzian metric. Now that we have this inner product on differential forms, we can define the adjoint for any operator that lives on that space of differential forms. So in particular, the exterior derivative is an operator that maps differential forms into differential forms, and we can look at its adjoint. And the adjoint will be called the co-derivative. Now, what is the adjoint operator? You may remember from linear algebra that when you take a matrix, you can calculate its adjoint. And you do that by taking the transpose and complex conjugate. But that's not something we can do here. We don't have matrices here. The adjoint is defined more abstractly, and it covers the linear algebra case as a special case. The adjoint of an operator is defined in this way. First, what is the domain of the adjoint operator? The domain of the adjoint to an operator A is defined to be, so the domain is the set of all vectors on which it is allowed to act, is defined to be those Hilbert space vectors which are such that there exists an omega in the Hilbert space so that the action of A on a vector Z in a product with V can also be represented as W with Z. In other words, instead of having A act to the right on Z, there ought to exist a vector a W such that you could equally well have A act on V, namely producing the vector W. So if for all V in the Hilbert space, there exists a supposed or proposed image under the action of a dagger, and in order to qualify as such, it has to have this property that whether you calculate A acting to the right and then this inner product, or A acting on the left, W being A acting on V, should be the same no matter which Z you use of the Hilbert space. So this somewhat convoluted definition of the adjoint is general enough to cover this case as well. So that's the domain, and the action of this is the domain of the adjoint operator, and the adjoint operator itself is simply that the adjoint operator acting on V is then, if this is for all those vectors V, for which such a W exists, etc. On this domain, we define the action of a dagger on V to be W. So this means that on the domain, we have that a dagger acting on the left to V, then the inner product with the Z is the same as A acting on the right to Z, and then the inner product with B. So the co-derivative delta is the anti-adjoint of D with respect to the inner product that we just defined using the hot star. It's called the anti-adjoint because we snuck in another minus sign here. Again, we would not necessarily have to put a minus sign there, but then we would later regret it because you would have to put it in another place in the definition of the D'Alembertian. So we define the co-derivative to be the adjoint of D in the sense that whatever D does on the right-hand side, the del does on the left-hand side. So it is the A dagger in with respect to that definition of adjoint. So instead of calling it, we could have called it D superscript dagger, according to these definitions, but the tradition is to call it not D superscript dagger, but to call it del. So what you need to remember here is that if you want to move this exterior derivative to the other side, you can, but then you have to call it the del. If you want to move this one to the other side, you can, but you have to call it a d then. So what is it explicitly? The co-derivative maps p forms into p minus 1 forms. So explicitly, it maps a P form into, take the P form, then apply the hot star, apply the exterior derivative, apply the hot star, and then this combination of factors here that are minus one or not minus one. One can prove various properties of the co-derivative. In particular, it has this property that its square is equal to zero. And that is inherited from the property of D, that its square, whose square is zero. Why? Well, remember what the co-derivative does. Its action is really star D star, apart from a factor of minus one, potentially. So the co-derivative is really simply star d star. What happens if you do that twice? Well, then you have star d star star d star. In the middle, you have star star. which is the identity up to possibly a factor of minus one. And so you have star, dd star then, but dd is zero. And so therefore that has to be zero as well. And that's interesting because that means we can now do similar definitions to what we did for D, the exterior derivative. Remember, if you take a differential form and the D of it is vanishing, then we say it is closed. When a differential form is the D itself from another of another differential form, then we say it is exact. And so similarly here, when we have a differential form whose del is zero, we will say it's co-exact, it's co-closed, and if a differential form is the delta of some other differential form, then we will say it is co-exact. Remember from yesterday, from Tuesday, when we did Stokes' theorem, and we said that in two dimensions, it boils down to, it covers as a special case, the Cauchy integral formula. It covers contour integration. And for that, to make that exact, you have to relate the Cauchy-Riemann equations of complex analysis to closeness conditions for differential forms. And one of the Cauchy-Riemann equations is that the differential form is closed, and the other one is that it is co-closed. Never mind the details. I think the main point to remember here is that contour integration is a special case of Stokes. In coordinates, the co-derivative takes this form. The co-derivative, if you spell it out in upper indices, you should really write it down in lower indices because we are acting with it on differential forms. But with the metric, we can freely move between them. And it is more convenient to write it with upper indices. Otherwise, you'd have to put a product of a lot of metrics to move the indices down. So written in upper indices, the co-derivative of a differential form is given by this expression. And we will later see this come up in the D'Alembertian. The co-derivative inherits one more thing from the exterior derivative. Remember, in the case of the exterior derivative, we had a theorem that said that if a manifold is contractible, or we consider a part of the manifold that is contractible, so it doesn't have any holes in it, so if a manifold is contractible, then if the manifold, if a differential form is closed, it is also exact. Right? So we said that if the D of a differential form vanishes, then it actually is the D of another differential form. So if it is closed, just write it up. So if we had that D omega equal to zero, meant that there exists a nu such that omega was equal to D nu. That's true for contractible manifolds or contractible parts of manifolds. And remember, that was the starting point for cohomology. When the manifold has holes and handles, that's not true. And therefore, not every closed differential form is exact. Every exact differential form is, of course, closed. Because if you have that omega is equal to d nu, then of course you have that d omega is equal to zero because it would be, because it is d squared of nu, right? So on a contractible part, on a contractible manifold or contractible part of the manifold, exactness and closeness are the same. But when there is non-trivial structure, they are not the same, and you can measure the difference between. That's how cohomology started. And what we see now is that this property is inherited by the co-derivative. If a differential form is co-closed, so del nu is equal to zero, then there exists a differential form such that nu is the del of that differential form, very similar to this one. It's just the co of it. You can prove that by just using the definitions. Basically, you just need to remember that the del is basically star d star up to minus sign. Oh, and also, look at the action of the coderivative. It is full of the metric. We would not have been able to define the coderivative without the metric. And also, this messes, the existence of the metric in here messes with the derivation property. While D is the derivation on the algebra of differential forms, the Grassmann algebra, the del is not. It just doesn't obey a nice Leibniz rule. And that's because the metric is messing it up. Okay, so now as a little example, let us apply our new operator del for something useful. Let us use D and del to obtain the Maxwell equations on a manifold. So we can define, for example, the field strength tensor, F mu nu, of electromagnetism. It is defined to be zero on the diagonal, and then you have the electric fields here on the off diagonals and the magnetic fields on the off diagonals, like this. And this is actually having two lower indices. So it is a covariant two tensor, and you see it's anti-symmetric. So it's actually two-form. So the field strength tensor is actually a differential two-form. The current that is often thought of as a four-vector is, you can also write as a differential form. And it's actually a current, it's actually called the current three-form. So it's the star of a four-vector. This is what you get when you apply the hot star to it. This is, sorry, I didn't write the metric in here because this was just the expression in Minkowski space. I could, you should put the square root of g in here to make it the proper hot star. So you can think of the current either as a one form, therefore as a covariant four vector, or after application of the hot star on it, you can think of it as a three form. Either way, the Maxwell equations are as follows. dF is equal to zero. This is the homogeneous Maxwell equations. And del F equal to star J, hot star, applied to the current. That is, these are the inhomogeneous Maxwell equations. And notice something interesting here. The homogeneous Maxwell equations, we could have written down before today. We don't need the metric for that. F mu nu doesn't have the metric in it, and D, the exterior derivative, doesn't have it either. So these are actually structural equations. They're called structural equations. Whereas the del F equal to this, that's non-trivial physics. And they depend on the metric. Further, the physics tells us, not the math, but the physics tells us that F, this differential two form that we just saw here, this one, has to be such, I mean the functions E of space and time and B of space and time, these functions have to be such that this two-form is actually exact. This F is the exterior derivative of a one-form, A, and that one-form is called the electromagnetic four-potential. It turns out that this requirement implies the homogeneous Maxwell equations right there, because clearly if F is the D of some one form, then the df has to be equal to zero, because it's the d squared of a. So in other words, to require these equations, the homogeneous Maxwell equations, is the same as to require that f is equal to da. On a contractible manifold, it's the same thing, because requiring exactness or closeness is the same. So requiring that the homogeneous Maxwell equation holds is the same as requiring that f of is equal to dA, which is the same as requiring the gauge principle, as we will find out. Okay, so this is also called a structure equation, because the equation of motion in this case follows from something that is not built into the Lagrangian or Hamiltonian or the action or anything. The homogeneous Maxwell equations follow simply because we want F to be an exact form.
When you wrote F on the previous slide, you wrote it in the components in the matrix, but doesn't that assume a coordinate system?
It assumes a basis in the space of one forms, and but not a particular coordinate system. I mean, you could choose any of those bases.
In a different basis, wouldn't the E and Vs be the different?
Yes. If you choose a basis other than the ones that come from the coordinate system, where these are Cartesian coordinates, then it would still be a totally anti-symmetric matrix, because you can't change it by change of basis. But the E's and the B's would be mingling together. They couldn't be cleanly separated. In fact, even under Lorentz transformations, of course, the E's and the B's mix already. Right, but I think it's an important point that no matter which coordinate system you choose, it's always anti-symmetric. And I mean, it's just, it was one of the conditions for being able to define differential forms. Anti-symmetry is independent of coordinate system. Once you have completely anti-symmetrized, you have completely anti-symmetrized it for all coordinate systems. Okay, so a point I wanted to make is that the homogeneous Maxwell equations are equivalently the statement that F is a closed differential form, or that F is an exact differential form. And it's a structural thing. It's not something we put into the Hamiltonian. It's a question, it's a statement about the physics. It's outside of Hamiltonian or dynamic considerations. We are saying that F is an exact differential form. That's nothing to do with dynamics per se. And so we call this condition a structure equation. We are relying on the structure of the mass of it to enforce certain equations of motion. And it turns out that general relativity also possesses structure equations. General relativity possesses equations that hold true no matter what action you choose. Whether the action is the Einstein-Hilbert action or some modified action, some equations are always true. They will be called Bianchi identities. They play a similar role to the homogeneous Maxwell equations. Now, a quick remark here. The gauge principle of electromagnetism is the observation that for any zero form, so for any function, of course, differentiable and all, we have that the physics described by the one form A and the physics described by the one form A tilde differing from A just by the addition of this gradient is the same. So remember, in electromagnetism, we say the field strength tensor is the D of some electromagnetic four potential. And what I just said is that this electromagnetic four potential is not unique. If you add to it the D of something, it doesn't matter. Obviously not, because if you add to A the D of something, well, that will go away under the action of the D. Right? So the D of open bracket A plus something else D, well, then that's it goes away. So that straightforward fact implies the gauge is the gauge principle. If we replace the A by an A tilde, which is A plus D omega, same physics because it's the same field strength tensor. This is true for electromagnetism, not true for the weak force, not true for the strong force. Because for the weak and for the strong force, the field strength tensors are not invariant under those transformations. But for electromagnetism, they are. Gauge transformations are more complicated for non-abelian gauge theories. And similarly, gravity is not as simple as that. So they describe the same physics, and that's because the F will not change under that action, and so the E and the B fields don't change under that action. So the F is the E and the B fields, that's the D of A, and that's the same as the D of A tilde. Okay, now we are finally ready to write down the Laplace and D'Alembert operators. As I indicated earlier, the Laplace operator is the anti-commutator of the D and the del. And it is, as we wanted it to be, a map from p-forms into p-forms, in particular functions into functions. Like for the Klein-Gordon equation, we need that it maps the Klein-Gordon field into the Klein-Gordon field and not into some other differential forms. And why does it do that? Well, it's because the D increases the index of a differential, the rank of a differential form by one, but the del decreases it by one. And so overall, it just maps p-forms into p-forms. If the signature is one, so if there's only one minus sign in the metric, then this is also called the D'Alembert operator, even though mathematicians tend to use the term Laplacian no matter what the signature is. But physicists would distinguish between Laplacians and D'Alembertians according to the signature of the metric. Also, some authors would define a minus sign in front of all of that. So that would be minus of the D'Alembertian. How does it look like explicitly if we apply our D'Alembert operator on zero forms, on functions? It turns out that when the so defined D'Alembert operator acts on functions, then this is how it does it. You take the function, differentiate it in the direction of x mu, multiply with the metric, multiply with the square root of the absolute value of the determinant, then differentiate again, that's the second derivative, and then take 1 over the square root of g. And I leave it to you as a little exercise to verify that this reduces to the usual D'Alembertian on flat space in Cartesian coordinates where the metric is just eta mu nu. This should be just that. It's very easy to show. So what are the properties then of this Laplacian? It maps R forms into R forms. It is the anti-commutator of D and del. In the Hilbert space, it is formally a self-adjoint operator. So you can act with it either to the right or move it to the left. And why is that? Well, because this is the anti-commutator of D and del. And as you move them over here, the D and the del become the del and the D. Because you just take the adjoint of them. And so the D'Alembertian goes into the D'Alembertian. So the D'Alembertian is formally self-adjoint as far as this algebraic test is concerned. But of course, if there are boundaries on the manifold, then you can pick up boundary terms. And then it may not be self-adjoint, and you may have to choose boundary conditions. But it would be generally self-adjoint if the manifold, let's say, doesn't have boundaries. If the manifold is positive definite, if the inner product is positive definite, which we know is always true for zero forms, but it may not be true for P forms. There it depends on the signature of the metric. Okay, and then other things you can then straightforwardly check if you have too much time and want to do some exercises, then the D'Alembert operator commutes with the action of the hot star. It also commutes with the action of the exterior derivative, and it commutes with the action of the co-derivative. Now, when the D'Alembertian is a self-adjoint operator, that is really great, because it means that they can be diagonalized by the spectral theorem. And they will have a real spectrum. So in particular, for Riemannian manifolds, it means that one can prove that the spectrum of the D'Alembert operator, or the Laplace operator, for Riemannian manifolds, the spectrum of the Laplace operator is positive. And for compact Riemannian manifolds, think of a manifold with a finite volume and no boundary. For compact Riemannian manifolds, we have that the spectrum of the Laplace operator is actually discrete. And that is an interesting object, the spectrum of the Laplace operator of a manifold, because it consists of a bunch of numbers which would be literally the frequencies with which the manifold would ring if you tapped it with a spoon, if it were made out of metal. Because you can just put a wave equation on that manifold to describe the vibrations of it, and then that wave equation would be governed by the Laplacian, and the spectrum would be literally, the frequency spectrum is literally the spectrum of the Laplacian there. And clearly, the frequencies, the eigenfrequencies, the vibrational eigenfrequencies of that manifold do not depend on which coordinate system you've painted on it. In other words, the eigenfrequencies, the natural frequencies of vibrations of the manifold, are characteristic of the shape of the manifold. They have nothing to do with the coordinate systems that you may choose. In other words, they're invariants, they're geometric invariants. Each eigenvalue is a geometric invariant that tells us something about the shape. So you can describe the shape of a manifold using the metric, of course, and later we will describe it using the curvature, and we will discuss a few other ways of describing the curvature, the shape of a manifold. But these spectra, the spectra of Laplacians, also tell us something about the shape of a manifold. About 100 years ago, even more than 100 years ago, Hermann Weyl first asked, how much can you actually hear if you take a two-dimensional manifold, let's say a vase, and you tap it with a spoon? The sound will, of course, convey some information about the shape of the vase, but how much is it? How much can we learn? We will cover that in more detail later on. So that that discipline is called spectral geometry, that tries to bring together the shape of a manifold and the sound it would make. I'm particularly interested in that field because I think it's cool that the spectrum of an operator is a functional analytic property and the shape of a manifold is a differential one, differential geometric one. So these are the languages of quantum theory and general relativity that are being brought together in this way. Yeah, so now that we have the D'Alembertian, we can define the Klein-Gordon action. We can define the Klein-Gordon field theory on a curved space-time, or, I mean, we haven't introduced the notion of curvature yet, just on a space-time with a metric. And we can do it this way. We take the usual Klein-Gordon action from special relativity. So we have the derivative in the x mu direction, x nu direction, and then this would be eta mu nu in special relativity. We make that g mu nu. And here's the full structure of all of this. This is really a covariant two-tensor that we've turned into a contravariant two-tensor by raising the indices. Here we have, these derivatives are really directional derivatives applied to a scalar field. All of that is spelled out in terms of basis vectors here. I'm just adopting the notation that you would use in physics normally already. Or we can spell it out in this way. Instead of using the commas, it's these derivatives. And the volume form, remember, is square root of the absolute value of the determinant of g, dxn. And then if we do an integration by part here, then we obtain in principle, a boundary term, but let's assume that the manifold doesn't have a boundary or that the fields vanish at whatever the boundary is. Then you obtain a term with a second derivative and a term with just the field phi. You must have done that many times, that in the action you've done a integration by parts. If we do that here, then we obtain an expression that looks complicated, but we can recognize it. This is phi times some second derivative operator acting on phi again. And that operator is the d'Alembert operator. So we saw the d'Alembert operator earlier, and it maybe looked a little bit complicated. Here it is. D'Alembert operator is this. It looks a little messy. Why 1 over square root of g? Why here and that business and so on? Why so complicated? Now we can see on the grounds of physics why it had to come out this way. Namely, if you just take your Klein-Gordon theory, spell it out, perform integration by parts so that you get the field and then second derivative operator, which would be in Minkowski space just the d'Alembertian, acting on phi again, then you see that because of the integration by parts, you have that this derivative that would normally just act on phi, because of the integration by parts, it acts on everything else but phi. It acts on this and this and that. Right? That's what we see now. If we integrate by parts, this phi will no longer be differentiated. Here it is. And this derivative acts on everything else. Here it is. This derivative is that one. It acts on everything else. That's why we have this complicated expression for the d'Alembertian. So we recognize this thing, and then we see that the action really takes this form. And then you can use, I think this is the last slide, yes. Yeah, and then you can use, as usual, the Euler-Lagrange equation, dL by d phi equal to derivative of dL by d, derivative of phi. Here, the Lagrangian is this. We obtain the Klein-Gordon equation. It's clearly that. Let me just close with saying where this comes up. There are three applications of scalar fields in nature so far. One is as scalar fields describe, for example, meson fields, composite particles like quark, anti-quark systems, such as the pion. They can be scalar fields, and they would be described in this way. One problem with that is that they're not fundamental. They are composite particles. They're made out of several, like two quarks and gluons and so on. These would be effective descriptions as scalar fields. But we also believe now that there is a Higgs field that's a fundamental scalar field, and also that there's an inflaton field, which is also fundamentally a scalar field. There is still a remote chance that the Higgs field might be the inflaton field, but that's not yet either proven or disproven. It's a possibility, so it's relatively unlikely. Right, so it seems that nature has two fundamental scalar fields, and this is how we can describe them on curved space-time. And of course, soon we will have to see how we describe the dynamics of the space-time itself. So far, we've only described how things that move on space-time, such as Klein-Gordon fields and Klein-Gordon and electromagnetic fields propagate on the space-time. We will now have to look into how the space-time itself dynamically evolves. Okay, any questions? Well then, have a nice weekend.